You've never been one to blend in. Your colors shine too big and too bright for that. Your wit, your fearlessness, the way you find beauty in, well, everything. It's what makes you unlike anyone else. You deserve a desert diamond in colors unlike anything else, too. From pale champagnes to deep ambers to smoky whiskeys. Natural colors that reflect all the shades of you. Discover Desert Diamonds. A diamond is forever.
Okay, let's unpack this. Have you ever found yourself constantly asking, are they mad at me? Or maybe you've perfected the art of the chameleon personality, sort of effortlessly shifting to match whoever you're with, and then you realize you've completely forgotten who you actually are. If any of that sounds familiar, well, get ready for some serious self-recognition during this deep dive. Today, we're diving into a fascinating review and summary of Meg Josephson's insightful book, Are You Mad at Me? How to Stop Focusing on What Others Think and Start Living for You. And I'll be honest, when I first saw that title, my inner critic sort of groaned, you know, oh, great, another self-help book. Huh. But let me tell you, this one really blew my expectations out of the water. It doesn't just skim the surface. It excavates the very foundations of these ingrained behaviors. It offers not just advice, but like profound understanding.
Yeah, what's truly fascinating here is how the book moves beyond those common, maybe surface-level encouragements we often hear, like just be more confident. Mm-hmm. Instead, it really digs into the underlying why. You know, the why behind behaviors like people-pleasing. It explores the subtle and sometimes not-so-subtle experiences that really planted the seeds of self-abandonment. So our mission today is to uncover these deeper roots, understand their profound, often unseen, impact, and maybe offer some insights that can genuinely shift your perspective on how you interact with the world and, importantly, with yourself.
Absolutely. So imagine we're going to illuminate this hidden yet incredibly common survival strategy, explore its surprisingly deep origins, and then crucially talk about how we can begin to reclaim our authentic selves from these deeply ingrained patterns. I have a feeling this is going to resonate with quite a few of you listening. So to kick us off, most of us are familiar with fight, flight, and freeze, right? As common responses to perceived threats, they're pretty well-known terms these days.
Or standard stress responses.
But the book introduces a fourth one, often overlooked and maybe disturbingly normalized response, fawning. What exactly is fawning, and how does it kind of fit in with these other, maybe more obvious responses?
That's a great question, because fawning really is the stealthiest of the trauma responses, I think. At its core, fawning means trying to make ourselves more appealing, maybe more agreeable or less threatening to a perceived source of danger. It's about pleasing, appeasing, accommodating others, all in order to feel safe. So instead of confronting or escaping, like fight or flight, we actually move toward the source of potential harm, hoping to neutralize it, you know, through compliance or agreement. It's kind of a proactive strategy to maintain peace, even if that peace is, well, precarious and definitely comes at a personal cost.
Right. So it's not just about avoiding conflict. It's about actively trying to pacify it.
Yeah.
That's a really powerful distinction. Yeah. And just to give everyone a contrast, let's quickly take through those other responses we usually hear about. Fight is pretty straightforward. Arguing, yelling, confronting head on.
Yeah, direct opposition.
Flight is physically leaving a situation, cutting ties, or maybe just disappearing emotionally sometimes.
That's avoidance, escape.
And freeze. That's when escape isn't possible, so you mentally check out. Through dissociation, emotional numbness, or even just constant daydreaming.
Shutting down.
Fawning, though, feels a little different. It almost looks like good behavior on the surface, doesn't it?
Precisely. And that's what's particularly insidious. The why fawning often remains hidden or is even normalized in our society. Our culture frequently, sometimes subtly, rewards it. I mean, think about it. We're often praised for being team players, right? Or for being selfless, even if that means consistently ignoring our own needs. Promotions might go to people please, who anticipate others' desires before they're even spoken. Compliments pour in when we consistently put others' comfort before our own. This kind of societal reinforcement makes it incredibly difficult to identify fawning for what it actually is, a protective trauma response. It just gets labeled as being nice or considerate.
That makes so much sense. So, okay, with that in mind, how does this fawning tendency actually develop in the first place? The book highlights that for many, especially women, and maybe those raised in high conflict or emotionally neglectful homes, fawning becomes second nature. Not just a habit, but like a crucial ingrained survival skill. It's the silent protector that keeps us asking, are they mad at me?
Exactly. Imagine a chaotic or maybe an unsafe childhood environment. A child in that situation quickly learns that fighting back, that just escalates danger.
Right.
Freezing offers little to no real protection, and running away physically often just isn't an option for a child. So in such circumstances, fawning becomes the go-to strategy. It's adaptive. They learn to earn safety by being helpful, agreeable, non-threatening, by essentially becoming indispensable or invisible in just the right ways. And this strategy, though it was adaptive at the time, it becomes deeply wired into their nervous system. It was the best, safest option available to them then.
Wow. And what's the long-term price? What's the cost of this constant fawning?
Well, the really significant price is self-abandonment. That's the core of it. We learn to prioritize others' comfort, their emotions, their needs, completely over our own. We feel unable to be okay, unable to relax until they are okay. I mean, think about how many times you might have said yes when you desperately wanted to say no.
Oh, absolutely.
Or found yourself automatically deferring to someone else's preference for dinner or a movie or even a bigger life decision, leaving your own desires totally unvoiced, unmet. That's the insidious cost, that self-abandonment. It's an utterly exhausting way to live.
Well, this brings up a really important distinction the book makes, the difference between being nice and being compassionate. Could you walk us through that? Like, if I'm at a party and I really want to leave because I'm exhausted, but I stay another hour because I don't want to seem rude, is that nice or compassionate?
That's a perfect example, and the book clarifies this beautifully. Being nice is often about how others perceive us. It's doing something to be viewed as good, or maybe to avoid perceived negative consequences, or to manage someone else's potential reaction. It's very externally focused, often driven by fear, really.
Okay.
Compassion, on the other hand, is about authenticity. It's choosing kindness because it genuinely feels right to you, because it aligns with your values, not because you're driven by a fear of what might happen if you say no or assert yourself. It's internally motivated, driven by genuine care, but crucially, without self-sacrifice. So staying at the party out of fear of seeming rude, that's likely nice.
Got it. And the source also points out how broader social conditioning plays a huge role in all this. It's not just our individual childhoods, is it?
Not at all.
Women, for example, are often taught from a very young age that anger makes them crazy or unhinged, you know, or that disagreement makes them difficult.
Mm-hmm. Those labels are powerful.
And this pressure is compounded by other factors too, right? Like race, class, gender identity, sexuality, cultural background, or disability. These can significantly deepen the need to fawn just to stay safe within oppressive systems or navigate unequal power dynamics.
Absolutely. It adds layers of complexity. And it's really crucial to remember that fawning isn't inherently bad. We have to keep that in mind. It is an adaptive survival mechanism. Sometimes it genuinely keeps us safe in dangerous situations. There are times when it's necessary.
Sure.
But when it becomes an unconscious, pervasive habit that we don't even recognize anymore, that's when it traps us. It traps us in this powerful and limiting belief. My safety depends entirely on pleasing you. And this belief can dictate our entire lives long after the original threats, the original dangers are actually gone.
Yeah. One key part of this fawn response you mentioned is something called hypervigilance. I mean, imagine your brain acting like a security camera on a constant loop, always scanning for danger, predicting moods, anticipating reactions. And as I read about this, I just recognized how utterly exhausting that constant mental scanning can be. It's not just a momentary feeling, is it, for people stuck in this pattern?
No, it's often a chronic state for many. This heightened awareness, it extends beyond just scanning the physical environment for threats. It involves constantly checking the emotional weather of those around us, trying to predict their moods, their reactions, their needs. Also, we can adapt our own behavior and keep things feeling safe, or at least keep them from escalating.
Right.
What might look like self-sabotage to an outsider, maybe always canceling plans or never voicing an opinion, is often, for the fawner, a deeply ingrained form of self-protection, developed over years. Those present fears that seem maybe irrational to others, they were often at one point essential tools for younger self just trying to survive.
Wow. The book also sheds fascinating light on the nature of trauma itself, emphasizing that trauma isn't defined just by the sheer size of an event.
Exactly. That's a common misconception.
Instead, it's defined by how our nervous system perceives and processes that event. Repeated small hurts those consistent experiences of feeling unsafe, unseen, unheard, or unloved. They can be just as damaging, sometimes more so, than one catastrophic event, leading to what's often called complex trauma.
And fawning often grows directly out of this kind of environment, these CPTSD situations.
Yeah.
These are situations where the relationships that should have felt safe and nurturing parents, caregivers instead felt unpredictable, neglectful, or even outright harmful.
Yeah.
Complex trauma isn't just about what happened. It's not just the emotional abuse, the verbal attacks, or the neglect. It's also profoundly about what didn't happen.
What do you mean?
The love, the support, the consistent care that were absent during or after pain, the lack of repair after conflict. And because it often builds slowly over time across childhood, it frequently felt normal simply because it was all that person knew.
Gosh, and building on that, another profound revelation from the book is that these wounds aren't always confined to a single lifetime. The book reveals that trauma can actually travel through generations. Is that right?
It is, yeah. It's a heavy concept, but the evidence is growing.
We can literally carry the unprocessed wounds, the unmet needs, the unresolved pain of our parents, grandparents, and ancestors. This profound concept is known as intergenerational trauma.
Yes. And a really powerful illustration of this comes from scientific research. There have been studies, for instance, looking at children of Holocaust survivors. These studies showed that they had genetic markers indicating lower baseline cortisol levels compared to Jewish adults whose parents were not survivors.
Lower cortisol. I thought stress raised cortisol.
Acutely, yes. But chronic, prolonged, intense stress can essentially overwork and dysregulate the HPA axis, that's your hypothalamic pituitary adrenal system, the body's stress control center. This dysregulation can lead to the body producing lower baseline levels of cortisol over time, which is actually a known biological marker for PTSD. It's a profound example of how our very biology, our bodies, can literally reflect ancestral tragedies, oppression, and losses. It's quite staggering.
That is staggering. So our bodies can actually hold these ancestral echoes.
Yeah.
And the book makes a crucial connection here. How fawning also disconnects us from our own bodies. So that makes sense.
Absolutely.
When we're constantly attuned to external threats and others' comfort levels, we learn to ignore our own physical and emotional cues, our own needs. We effectively abandon our internal experience.
We'll numb out.
Yeah. And in a culture that bombards us with messages that our worth depends on being smaller, slimmer, younger, or just somehow different from who we are right now, this disconnection is incredibly profitable, isn't it, for industries that thrive on our self-loathing and dissatisfaction?
It absolutely is. So to be truly embodied, which means to be in tune with your body, accepting it in all its seasons, cycles, and changes, just as it is, that becomes an act of quiet rebellion in such a culture. It really does.
A quiet rebellion. I like that.
It's declaring, I have value right now, exactly as I am. Rejecting that constant external pressure, that idea that you need to become less in some way to be worthy of love, attention, or success. This reconnection to the body is vital for healing from fawning because it helps us tune back into our own needs, our own signals.
And sometimes this deep-seated need to protect ourselves can manifest in a surprising way as hyper-independence. This isn't just liking your own space. It's that deeply ingrained belief that you have to handle everything yourself.
Yeah.
That it's fundamentally unsafe to lean on anyone else.
Yeah.
Where does fawning fit into this picture? It seems almost opposite.
It does seem opposite, but fawning plays a quiet yet significant role here too. While you might seem open and agreeable on the surface, that's the fawning part. This underlying mechanism actually allows people in only to a certain controlled depth.
Okay.
It creates an emotional barrier. It keeps others from truly seeing the real vulnerable you, which in turn reinforces that belief that you must be entirely self-reliant because nobody really gets you or can handle you. And this emotional barrier created by fawning means that even when we seem agreeable on the outside, we're holding back the truly vulnerable parts of ourselves, which makes genuine reciprocal connection feel impossible, or at least very risky, which then just reinforces the belief that we're alone and needing to handle everything. It's a cycle.
Ultimately, then, how deeply we can connect with others is directly tied to how deeply we're connected to ourselves.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
I think that's exactly right.
If we've learned to abandon or hide our true feelings and needs, if we're constantly monitoring the emotional weather of others just to keep ourselves feeling safe, then genuine intimacy, where we are fully seen and accepted, flaws and all, will always feel just out of reach.
Mm-hmm. It remains elusive.
So, okay, with all this incredible insight, this understanding, what does this all mean for us, for someone listening who recognizes themselves in this? When healing from the fawn response, what's the approach? The book says the key is to move slowly, right?
Yes, slowly is crucial.
Taking steps that stretch your comfort zone, but without overwhelming your body or triggering that deep-seated sense of unsafety. It's about gentle, deliberate progress, not some sudden overhaul.
Absolutely. You want to titrate the experience. Mm-hmm. Begin with people you feel safest with, your closest circle, and start in what the book calls low-stakes situations. This isn't about making grand, dramatic gestures or confronting everyone in your life immediately.
Okay.
It's about small, deliberate actions that gradually teach your nervous system, that retrain it, to understand that it's safe to assert yourself, even in really minor ways.
Could you give some examples? What does that look like practically?
Sure. The book offers some really concrete, relatable examples that you can try. It could be as simple as telling a close friend, hey, I only have 30 minutes to chat right now, when they call, because you genuinely have another commitment or just need time.
Right, instead of letting it go for an hour when you can't.
Exactly. Or maybe letting your partner know, hey, I'd really like some quality one-on-one time this week, just the two of us, without distractions, voicing that need. Or even telling a trusted coworker, actually, I'd rather not eat lunch at the same place every single day. Maybe we could switch it up. I'm trying to save money, or whatever the real reason is.
These aren't huge demands, are they? But they feel like important steps.
They are huge steps internally. Each time you do this, each time you voice even a small, authentic need or boundary, you're sending a powerful, crucial message. You're sending it to that part of you that still feels afraid, the part stuck in the past trauma response. The message is, it's safe now. It's safe to speak up for my needs. The sky isn't falling.
Reassuring that younger part.
Precisely. And with every small win, you're not just practicing a new behavior. You're also rebuilding something incredibly precious.
Yeah.
Your self-trust. You're showing yourself, proving to yourself that your voice matters and that you can be okay even when you assert yourself.
That's really hopeful. And to leave you with a powerful thought directly from the book, the author Meg Josephson, she says this. I had been taught up until that point that keeping quiet kept the peace, but then I realized it wasn't my peace I was keeping, and I was tired of it.
That hits home, doesn't it? Whose peace are you keeping?
Yeah, wow. This deep dive into Are You Mad at Me? It really shows us how many of our seemingly nice or agreeable behaviors might actually be these deeply ingrained survival mechanisms.
Mm.
Understanding fawning, understanding hypervigilance, and the true nature of trauma. It offers a really powerful pathway, I think, to genuine self-connection and more authentic living.
Absolutely. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it's about recognizing the profound impact of past experiences, sometimes our own, sometimes even those from generations ago, on our present-day behaviors and relationships. It offers a much more compassionate lens, doesn't it? A way to view ourselves and our struggles, moving away from self-blame and toward understanding, acceptance, and ultimately healing.
Yes. Ultimately, as the book powerfully reminds us, once we stop focusing so much energy on what others think, we can finally begin to remember who we truly are beneath all those layers of conditioning and protection. Find our way back to ourselves.
Mm. So perhaps this raises an important question for you to ponder this week. Little takeaway. In what area of your life might you be keeping someone else's peace, maybe unconsciously, at the expense of your own? And thinking about those small steps, what tiny, truly safe-feeling step could you possibly take this week to reclaim just a little piece of that peace for yourself?
That's a great question to sit with. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive, everyone. We really hope it's given you some powerful insights and maybe some useful tools for your own journey.